lecture with Tanya Bronigan. Her new book is Red Memory, The Afterlives of China's Cultural Revolution. Remembering all these decades later is a fresh way of participating in history when you were too young or weren't even alive to remember these events. They can sometimes feel like the English Revolution of the 17th century. And we still speak of events that happened in 1605, the gunpowder plot, and Oliver Cromwell, the Puritans riding across the land. America comes out of that period. So when we recreate our history, that's what we're doing. We're living through it as if it informs us today. It's sentimental, but at the same time, it can be stirring. In this instance, however, people who were too young to understand what was happening around them as grown-ups have clubs or groups or friendship across the internet. And sometimes they meet in person. And entertaining this group or entertaining everybody in Beijing and Shanghai, wherever he travels, is an impersonator of the most famous villain of the gang of, well, the man who was chief rival to Mao Zedong. This flabbergasted me, Tanya. The man who looks like, his name was Liu, is that, that was the man who's...
Lin Biao.
Lin Biao, yes, Lin Biao. Was,
yes, I mean, Lin Biao, I have to say I was fairly flabbergasted to discover a Lin Biao impersonator as well. I mean, there are plenty of Mao impersonators, other key figures like Zhou Enlai and so forth. Lin Biao was much more surprising precisely because he's been vilified for so long as the sort of the greatest enemy of the people, really. Even though he died before the end of the Cultural Revolution, he was actually given a posthumous show trial for his responsibilities for the era. And he had this extraordinary trajectory in which he went from being something of a military hero through to being really Mao's chief sycophant, essentially, the person who was doing the most, or one of the most, to foment the Cultural Revolution, to create this personality cult. It was him who kind of developed the first little red books when he was leading the army. And so he was defense minister, but more than anything, he's really remembered for telling people to follow Mao, lauding Mao, praising him to the skies. Whether he believed all this or it was simply tactical is a very good question. But in any case, even sycophancy really wasn't safe in that era. It was a time that was so unstable and turbulent that only Mao himself could feel secure at that time. And so Lin Biao, who had been so central to Mao's mission in the Cultural Revolution, quite quickly begins and is positioned as his successor and his heir apparent. In a way, although Mao chooses to do that, it also really seals his fate, because quite quickly he falls into Mao's disfavor. One strange thing is that because the only way to advance in that time is to praise Mao to the skies, the very fact of praising Mao then becomes suspect to Mao. So really, whatever you do, you're doomed. And so he falls from favor. It becomes clear that Mao's turning upon him, and he and his wife and his son then try to flee China in a plane in very mysterious circumstances. And the plane crashes again in rather mysterious circumstances in Mongolia. Not entirely clear what happened, still remains a mystery. But as I said, he was vilified after his death. When people were finally told about it, which was not for many months, they were told that Chairman Mao had been sort of nurturing really this viper. And it was a critical moment for the Cultural Revolution, because I think people really thought, well, either Chairman Mao has made this sort of terrible mistake, in which case he can't be the great godlike figure that we trusted him to be, or he's just vengeful towards people around him, and he's this sort of emperor dispatching people who've fallen from favor. And also, of course, because Lin Biao had been at this sort of forefront of praising and lauding Mao and the Cultural Revolution, and then suddenly they're told, well, he didn't believe in any of that. So if the person who'd been its chief champion didn't believe in it, then really, why should they? And so this came about halfway through the Cultural Revolution, and it was the point at which really even people who had kept a degree of idealism or belief began to think again.
The clubs that come together to remember the Cultural Revolution are the grown-up men and women who were called educated youth when they were forced, mandated, dispatched, deployed, banished to the countryside. You speak to several of the women who are now in their 60s and 70s, and the way out of the crude conditions where they lived, always brutalized, they had no protection, they were not with their parents. But what is striking about it is that many years later, they enjoy talking about it. They enjoy I got the feeling this was like 1966, bandstand. You know, they dance with each other. They remember rock and roll. Is that what it's like to be with them?
So I think people do have very strong memories of their adolescence. We know that psychologists talk about what they call a memory bump between about the age of 15 and 25, roughly. And these are clearly such intense experiences as well that it's not surprising perhaps they would recall them and even find sort of pleasure where they could. And nostalgia as well is always about what we think of the world today, isn't it? So people were looking at a world in China that they saw as being much more focused on money, thinking much less about other moral values perhaps, where there was growing inequality, there was grotesque corruption in many cases, and people were really harking back to what, in a sense, they saw as a more innocent time, as strange as that sounds. And that was obviously easier for people who'd had a less painful experience of the Cultural Revolution. But in some cases, even people who had quite bitter experiences still wanted to meet up and talk about it and perhaps gain some sense of meaning, a feeling that it wasn't all just wasted, that there was some purpose to their experiences. And it's not something that's unique to China, of course. You think about a show like The Waltons, it's odd that, you know, there's this immense affection for the 1930s, a time of immense poverty and difficulty and even desperation for many people, and yet one that somehow has this rather rosy glow around it now.
It was impossible not to like them. They were very warm towards you, telling stories. There didn't seem to be any psychological pain in recovering. Even the stories about how they got out of the village, how they married, how they ran away, how they were isolated. It was convincing that human beings adapt to the best circumstances they can. And good for them. We're going to turn now to a story later in the Cultural Revolution, 1970, that is horrible to consider, but it's part of the legacy. The book is Red Memory. Tanya Bronigan is the author. The Afterlives of China's Cultural Revolution. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.